Hello, it's Thursday the 16th of September and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. Kim Yo-jung, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has criticized South Korean President Moon Jae-in for remarks he made as he oversaw SLBM tests on Wednesday. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly. On this week's Korean Politics Digest, we'll take a look at the latest developments in the primary races for the two main rival parties. And then for Explore Korea Today, we're starting a new travel series based on locations featured in the latest season of a hugely popular video series made by the Korea Tourism Organization. We'll have all that and more coming up next. North Korea has slammed South Korea for raising tensions on the peninsula. The comments come from Kim Yo-jung, the powerful sister of the North's leader Kim Jong-un, who singled out South Korean President Moon Jae-in by name for the very first time. For the latest on North's rebuke of the South, as well as other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio News Editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So North Korea has reproached President Moon for saying that the South's missile advances would help deter the North's provocations. At the same time, the North today, Thursday, also touted its own military advances, confirming that it successfully tested the launch of ballistic missiles, this time from a railway train convoy. Well, we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, can you tell us more about Kim Yo-jung's comments?
Yes, Kim Yo-jung's sister and close confidant to the reclusive leader blasted South Korean President Moon in a statement released late on Wednesday, sarcastically saying that Moon may have made a slip of the tongue by using the term provocation to describe North Korea's tests of ballistic missiles earlier that day, as well as long-range cruise missiles tests launched over the weekend. In a statement carried by the Korean Central News Agency, she rejected speculations that North Korea is engaging in provocations, claiming that it is proceeding with normal and self-defensive activities under the country's five-year plan for defense and arms development. She said its tests are no different from that of the South's test launches under its so-called midterm defense plan. President Moon on Wednesday observed an underwater test launch of an SLBM and said South Korea's enhanced missile capabilities can deter North Korea's provocations. Kim warned that such comments will only lead to corresponding action without specifying what that would be and that inter-Korean relations will end in catastrophe.
So as we reported yesterday, Wednesday, North Korea test-fired two short-range ballistic missiles into the East Sea. We received confirmation from the North that they were launched from a railway-borne regiment for the first time. Can you elaborate on the North's statement as well as the international response?
Of course. The KCNA reported early on Thursday that its launch came from a railway-borne missile regiment firing two ballistic missiles that flew some 800 kilometers and hit a target in the East Sea. The four photographs released by the state-run mouthpiece showed the missiles at the moment it took off from the train. Although North Korea's Kim Jong-un was not on hand to observe the event, Park Jong-chan, a member of the Presidium of the Politburo of the ruling Workers' Party, oversaw the proceedings. Park reportedly said the railway-borne missile system holds great significance in enhancing the country's deterrence. The latest developments will likely hamper South Korea's efforts to offer inter-Korean rail development projects as one of many possible ways to coax North Korea back to the nuclear negotiating table, as the railway can be construed as a means to stealthily launch missiles without prior detection by the watchdog nations and organizations. The U.S. State Department condemned North Korea's missiles saying it is in violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions and posed a threat to its neighbors and the international community. The UN Council on Wednesday also gathered behind closed doors for an emergency session on North Korea, saying that the latest tests pose a major threat to peace and security and are a clear violation of the Council's resolutions.
Let's move on now to South Korea's COVID-19 situation. Daily infection figures are hovering around the 2,000 mark for a second day. Can you break down the latest figures for us?
Yes. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 1,943 additions on Thursday, bringing the cumulative total to 279,930. The Greater Seoul metro area reported 1,506 domestic cases, accounting for 78.4% of all local transmissions. The government will ease restrictions during the major holiday to allow private gatherings of up to 8 people in the capital region from Friday, provided they include 4 fully vaccinated people. However, such family gatherings will only be allowed at home in areas under level 4, with eating out or outdoor activities banned. The eased cap will be in place until next Thursday. Eating at expressway rest stops will also be prohibited, with only takeouts allowed during that period. Restaurants at all express rest stops managed by the Korea Expressway Corporation will only allow takeouts. Also, temporarily screening clinics will be set up at 9 major expressway rest areas. The government will collect highway tolls from next Monday to Wednesday, in contrast to prior the global pandemic, when fees were waived during major holidays. The government will use that revenue to fund quarantine efforts. The Korea Transport Institute estimates that nearly 32.3 million people will visit their hometowns during the holiday.
And finally, Typhoon Chanthu is expected to directly impact Jeju Island starting Thursday afternoon. Can you give us the latest typhoon update?
Of course. According to the Korea Meteorological Administration, Chanthu, the 14th typhoon of this year, was moving north at 20 kilometers per hour from waters some 230 kilometers south by southwest of Seogwipo as of 5 p.m. Thursday. The weather agency forecasts that the typhoon will come closest to Jeju at 8 a.m. Friday, after passing through waters some 60 kilometers southwest of Seogwipo at 3 a.m. Friday. The agency projected that the typhoon will dump between 50 and 80 millimeters of rain per hour from Thursday afternoon to Friday morning. The island is set to see between 100 and 300 millimeters of rainfall through Friday, with some areas likely to see more than 400 millimeters.
Thank you for those updates, Ijin.
Thank you.
Next up, it's time for our Thursday in-depth corner, Korean Politics Digest. And we have once again a lot to cover this week, from the government's anti-corruption office booking presidential hopeful Yoon Suk-yeol over allegations of political meddling, to the latest in the primary races for the two main rival parties. So let's jump right in and bring in our regular expert guest. We have joining us on the line Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Joining us once again, Professor Kim, hello.
Hi, happy to be with you.
Now, Professor, we have to start off from where we left off last week, because there have been developments over the allegations of political meddling by the presidential hopeful for the main opposition People Power Party and former Prosecutor General Yoon Suk-yeol. The Corruption Investigation Office for High-Ranking Officials, or the CIO, revealed that they booked Yoon last week, Thursday, on 4 charges, including power abuse, disclosure of official secrets, as well as violation of privacy and election laws. On Monday, the CIO also resumed a raid of the office of the main opposition People Power Party lawmaker Kim Ung, who was reportedly involved in this scandal. Meanwhile, the Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office has launched an investigation into the allegations as well. Yoon is, of course, pushing back on all these allegations. So, Professor, we don't want to go into whether you think these allegations are true or not, as the investigation is ongoing and we don't have the hard facts yet to go on. Now that the CIO is involved, it does add a weight to the situation. How much do you think this situation could drag down Yoon's presidential bid? Recent polls are showing that he's being overtaken by his leading rival, Hong Jun-pyo, for the first time.
Right. The CIO's involvement, indeed, I agree with your observation, is a very important development in this very potentially important issue. And we have different scenarios here. The thing is, as I mentioned many times with regard to this kind of political scandals before in this program, we need facts. No one should be immune to any kind of cover-ups or anything like that, and there should be no exception in this country in terms of any potential wrongdoings. And having said that, I think somebody on two opposite sides, someone will have to pay a heavy price for this case. Number one, let's say Mr. Yoon, if he has done this thing, we have to say it's incredibly stupid wrongdoing, because he was in a position, head of public prosecutors, and at the time, politically speaking, he was in a position where millions and millions of eyes are watching. The whole nation was watching in his relationship with the president, and then his alleged defense of public prosecutors. We knew every step he takes, every move he makes will become the public target of a public scrutiny. And despite such knowledge, if he has done something that's terribly illegal like this, as the allegations say, he will have to pay heavily for that stupidity, for sure. There's no question about it. On the other hand, however, if there is some kind of political motivation behind this accusation and someone is making up this kind of incredibly unbelievable story, incredible story in the sense, for the same reason, I mean, Mr. Yoon doing these stupid things in such a highly, exposed position, this doesn't make sense. And if somehow this is a wrong accusation, whoever came up with the idea will have to heavily pay for it. So at this time, as you mentioned, we don't know the facts at this time. We should know the facts. And after that, someone on the opposite side will have to heavily pay for this. And, it makes the perfect sense for different reasons, making public service more transparent and balanced on one hand, and on the other hand, making our election free of this mudslinging and this negative campaign and so on. So I think it serves either way greatly for public interest.
But Professor, even if Yoon is cleared of these allegations and accusations, couldn't it be too late? Couldn't it really have a detrimental effect on Yoon's presidential bid?
Depends. We really don't know, right? Because we're not gods, and there are different ways this could pan out. And if he was indeed wrongly accused, well, there is a chance that such evidence may surge, and then whoever came up with this accusation may be crucified, as I hope will be the case. And then, if actually this is his wrongdoing. He should pay for it, and he should pay heavy price for it. And it will definitely, as you mentioned, will change the whole landscape of the presidential election for sure. Yep.
Yes, we'll see what the investigations do bring up. In the meantime, there could be, of course, political consequences. Now, while we're on the subject of Yoon and the PPP race, let's talk more about the party situation in the primary races. The number of contenders for the PPP presidential primary have been cut down from 11 to 8. On Wednesday, the party's election management committee revealed the results of the first round of cuts carried out by surveying party members and the general public. The 8 include Yoon Sung-yeol, Hong Jun-pyo, Yoo Sung-min, and the former head of the Board of Audit and Inspection, Choi Jae-young. Now, Che was seen as a strong alternative to Yoon when he first joined the race. And I believe, Professor, when his name first came up, we discussed him here on Career 24 and his promising-looking credentials. But his numbers have not picked up. And although he is in the final eight, a day before the cutoff was announced, Che decided to disband his presidential campaign. So what do you read into Che's move there?
It's a very interesting move, and I haven't really seen totally credible explanation for it. So I think we need slightly more time at least to figure out what he has in mind. But different speculators and professional analysts have pointed out that maybe possibly what Che Jae-yong is trying to do is try to go with the so-called Lee Jun-seok model. When Lee Jun-seok was running for the party leadership, he was doing it without a large team. He just maintained his own very core support staff, and then he went alone by himself. But presidential campaign going that way, I have a great difficulty in believing such model could work. Lee Jun-seok's model was for the party leadership position, but presidential campaign is very different, and maybe possibly he's trying to adopt this campaign model only for the intra-party competition. Maybe when he's chosen by People's Power Party as the party candidate, I'm sure he will change it. But so for the next few weeks' time, if this kind of model, Lee Jun-seok model, could work or not, we'll have to wait and see. But the bigger point about Che Jae-yong's candidacy here is, his campaign has been working out or how it has not been working out altogether. Hmm. And basically, he's a very decent person. Well, there's plenty of evidence that he's a very nice, decent person, a balanced one who's not flamboyant. In that sense, I guess he's sort of like Jeong Tae-kyun, who's very mild-mannered, gentle and kind, 360-degree nice guy image, but who had to step down from exit the race on the ruling party side. Mm. And maybe he's sort of like he shares similar the dilemmas and challenges like a Yoo Seung-min centrist in a way, trying to keep the balance and then trying to be reasonable on all fronts and everything. And we know altogether, Che Jae-yong is seeking probably the Lee Hae-chang model in the presidential campaign, the big picture. I talked about Lee Jun-seok model in this particular time or moment, but in the big picture, the whole race, maybe he's thinking about Lee Hae-chang model, where his predecessor, the head of the Board of Audit, former judge, became such a strong candidate in presidential race, but he never made it, however. But maybe what he has, Che Jae-yong is having in mind is the Lee Hae-chang model. The only problem that I see in doing so is the model is too old. This is close to 20 years old model. 20 years ago, this was happening. And at that time, what was happening was the overall, the vetting process, the public, when he was examining the candidates, the media technology, information technology environment was not set up the way it is right now, where the candidates are really exposed to really hard grueling in terms of their policy knowledge, what they have to say about different policies and stuff like that. The former judge, Lee Hae-chang, if he had been exposed to this kind of system of vetting that we face right now, he may not have survived at all then. So the environment and the landscape has changed, and then probably problem is Che Jae-yong is just following the old model. That could be the issue.
Yeah. When you say Lee Hae-chang model, can you just briefly explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, Lee Hae-chang, he was the head of Board of Audit under President Kim Yong-sam, YS Kim, and then Che Jae-yong did, Lee Hae-chang stood up against the current president at that time, Kim Yong-sam, and he gained his name, and then afterwards he ran for presidency twice as the Conservative Party's candidate. And they have very largely not totally identical, but very similar profile, a former judge and head of Board of Audit, and then opposing, standing up against their boss, the president.
I see. So you don't think his disbandment of the presidential campaign is a move that suggests that he's giving up at all, very briefly?
Oh, I don't think it's premature to say he's giving up. He's quite desperate. He's trying what he can, and he's willing to try very wild card like this one as well. So, he's standing at a very critical crossroad at this point, for sure.
Sure. We'll see how his campaign continues for now. Let's turn to the ruling Democratic Party. Sunday's regional primary vote in the eastern province of Gangwon resulted in another landslide win for Gyeonggi Province Governor Lee Jae-myung ahead of former Prime Minister Lee Nak-yeon. But coming in third was former Justice Minister Chu Mi-ae. She overtook the former Prime Minister Chung Se-kyun, who you mentioned earlier. He was also considered another strong contender initially, but his campaign has faltered, and on Monday he officially dropped out of the race. Professor, what do you make of Chung's decision? What went wrong for him?
Yeah, I guess overall, if you want quick answer to this, I would say this is the dilemma of centrist nice guy Chung Se-kyun. If we look at his resume, possibly he's one of the best resume in this nation. One of those people who have the best possible resume. Chung Se-kyun was the head of the party. He was multiple time lawmaker. He was head of industry minister. He had it even National Assembly as the speaker. And when he actually took up his job as a prime minister, a lot of people were raising issues about it because he was the head of the legislature, and now he was chosen, he accepted his job as head of the executive branch. And so he has best possible resume in his hand, and he's known to be an ultra, ultra nice guy to just everyone, 360 degrees, and very mild mannered, and very rational, and well-educated, know the issues, and, totally no-nonsense guy. But the thing is, when you're such a well-rounded and well-balanced person, you're just not exciting in political campaign. And the 4% support level that we saw in the poll just reminded us again the nature of political campaign, which I personally think is very, very unfortunate, because we want nice, well-rounded, well-educated, well-informed, well-balanced person to lead the nation. But in election political campaigns, they just don't excite the people. Same problem goes to Yoo Seung-min, perhaps on the opposite side here. And just it's a reminder that only flamboyant, maybe Donald Trump was great evidence to support this argument. You have to be flamboyant. You have to have a strong colors and have a very, very edgy argument to even you should be able to infuriate people to get elected. So I guess it's a reminder of a sad fact that really niceness doesn't really work in political campaigns. I don't know. That's my opinion.
Right. Maybe in campaign politics, the nice guys do finish last. Who do you think are the winners then of him dropping out? Who do you think benefits from it?
We know Lee Nak-yeon's camp. Lee Nak-yeon's team is hoping big time that they're going to draw Chung Se-kyun's supporters' votes, because they share, Lee Nak-yeon and Chung Se-kyun, they say share similar background, coming from Jeolla province, and both prime minister and kind of a better balanced and less flamboyant and everything. So Lee Nak-yeon is hoping big time, that we know for sure. But Lee Jae-myung was probably the front runner right now. He was very much aware of this fact, so that's why he came out immediately after this announcement saying, Chung Se-kyun is the one who made me possible today, because he's the one who nominated me as the candidate for the Seongnam City mayor when I ran for the mayorship. And he made Lee Jae-myung today possible. So he was working very hard to work against the natural calculation that, Chung Se-kyun supporters would probably go to the Lee Nak-yeon side. Mm.
And importantly, Chung Se-kyun hasn't thrown his support behind either candidate yet, so we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, Lee Nak-yeon, who, as we said, is running second in the DP race, we mentioned last time how he had declared that he would resign as a lawmaker to focus on the presidential race, but at the time it was unclear whether other lawmakers would vote in favour of it, as the National Assembly rules say it has to be voted on. Well, they did, and his resignation was approved, which means that the Jongno constituency in Seoul will be vacant until by-elections set to be held on the same day as the presidential election on March 9th next year goes ahead. What did you make of this development, Professor, and the Jongno seat? It's an important symbolic one, isn't it, with past presidents such as Noh Myung-hyun and Lee Myung-bak holding that seat. But how important really is that seat, and what does it mean for the parties?
Yeah. You know, I don't fully understand why this is being said, but they do indeed, media say Jongno is the address number one in terms of the political district. It tops the list of the important Simpsons in terms of political district. I guess that's because Jongno is more like a free from the party affiliation, always in the center, and key figures have run for the district. But anyway, one way or another, it's very important, symbolically, critically important. I think together with Jongno, probably Seocho A and then Cheongju vicinities districts will also be up in the list for by-election at the time of presidential election. And so it will be very interesting to watch what happens. And they're saying, analysts are saying that after the Democratic Party, the ruling party, and then opposition People's Power Party finalize and choose their candidates, probably it will be determined who will be running in the Jongno district. And on the Democratic Party side, ruling Democratic Party side, Im Jong-seok, the chief of staff who served President Moon Jae-in as the first one, I believe, for quite some time, could run. And then Park Young-sun, the candidate running for the mayoral race, defeated by Oh Se-hun, Park Young-sun, former Ministry of SMEs, and she might run again. And also there is an interesting speculation, and even Chumie, after the presidential race is over inside the party, and if she becomes a free person, she may run for this seat again. On the People's Power Party side, interesting speculation, Lee Jun-seok, the party leader, may actually run for this seat. And he will, if he does so, he will compete against big names like Na Kyung-won, again, an important figure in mayoral race. And they're even saying Choi Jae-young, if he drops out of presidential race, the one that we just talked about, could actually join this race. And even Hwang Kyo-won, the one of the finalists, one of the first round, the person who passed the first round in the PPP presidential competition, and former Prime Minister Hwang Kyo-won could actually join here as well. So basically, this is a wild, wild west. All the big names, like the big names, they'll all come in and they'll try to take this seat. So it'll be very entertaining to watch the whole process of this this campaign together with the presidential campaign.
Right, this sort of sub-race next to the presidential race next year. That'll be interesting to watch. We'll leave it there for this week's Korean Politics Digest. Professor Kim, thank you as always for your analysis and have a great Chuseok holiday.
Thank you. Same to you, too. Thanks very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 23.31 points, or 0.74% on Thursday, closing the day at 3,130.09. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 3.36 points, or 0.32%, to close at 1,039.43. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 1.31 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,171.8 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. For this part of the show, we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online. And today, it's the turn of Chung Yeon to bring us those stories. And she joins us on the line now. Yeon, hello.
Hello, Chung.
So what topics do you have for us today, then?
First, we'll talk about how an older individual in a dire situation had to wait hours for emergency response after dialing 119. Then we'll look into a girl that was kidnapped for a short time, only for authorities to discover that she was part of a voice phishing ring. And lastly, we'll end off with news of SpaceX entering the privatized space race in a very big way.
Okay, so we start with a 119 emergency call that didn't go as it was supposed to. Can you tell us more?
Yes. On Wednesday, the Chungbuk Fire Department reported that an individual in their 80s called the emergency response number 119 twice around 10 p.m. after collapsing in their home in Cheongju, North Chungcheong Province. However, after the calls were received, no one from the rescue team arrived to help, and the individual was left unattended for over 7 hours until a family member had to redial 119 the following morning.
Wow, so he was left alone for 7 hours. First, Yeon, is the person okay? And do we know why there wasn't an immediate response to the emergency call?
To answer your first question, luckily the family member's call went through and the person in need was taken to the hospital. Currently, they have been diagnosed with cerebral infarction. And as for the response, or lack thereof, the 119 dispatcher who received the calls at the time said that the first call was cut off short as soon as they picked up, and there was miscommunication because of incorrect pronunciation during the second call.
Still, you would have thought that there would be some sort of follow-up if that had happened. So what's been the response from the authorities about the 119 dispatcher and to the incident itself?
The Chungbuk Fire Department has requested an audit of the employee to get insight into the exact circumstances. However, an official from the department said that according to their manual, attention should be paid particularly when an older person files a report and responders must be dispatched to every call. They reveal that the dispatcher has acknowledged their wrongdoings and the audit results will be taken into consideration upon deciding whether to take disciplinary action against the employee along with a degree of action.
I see. As we said, the caller has been treated and hopefully they will be okay, but the situation could have been, of course, a lot worse. Okay, let's move on to our second story now. What are we looking at?
It recently was reported that five male adults forced a middle school girl into their vehicle and took off on September 2nd around 10 p.m. in Hongdae Seoul. The girl immediately contacted her parents for help and her mother contacted a local police station. Surprisingly, the kidnappers dropped the girl off in front of an elementary school in Yeongdaengpo District, Seoul, and disappeared. According to the police investigation, the men were targeting the girl's money, who at the time of the kidnapping had a whopping 27 million won, over 23,000 USD in cash.
Wow, okay. So what was this middle school doing with that kind of cash, Yeowon?
Police found that the girl was being used as a money collector for a voice phishing ring.
Right, I see. Okay, so voice phishing refers to a crime where the offending party makes fraudulent phone calls to try and scam victims into giving them money. In fact, we just talked about taxi drivers helping crack down on such crimes on yesterday's Korea Trending. But what we're talking about today is quite different, as the offenders were using this middle school girl to act as a sort of collector of some kind then.
That's right. She had collected 30 million won from victims of financial fraud and ran away. The five men who kidnapped the girl were from the fishing ring she was working for. The girl had already spent 3 million won, hence why the men were only able to take the remaining 27 million won.
Well, 3 million won is about $2,500, so she'd used it quite a bit already then. So the fact that we have these details suggests that the police were able to track down these supposed kidnappers. So what is going to happen to these men, and what about the girl? Do we know if she was a willing accomplice or not?
Yes, all five men were caught on Tuesday. Mapo police tracked down the kidnappers based on CCTV footage around the scene of the incident and the student's statement. The Mapo police station sent them to the Seoul Western District Prosecutor's Office on charges of special robbery. And as for the middle school girl, a police official said that her participation in the voice phishing crime will be investigated as a separate case.
Well, that is quite a set of circumstances indeed. Okay, let's continue on to our final trending story now. Yeowon, what are we looking at?
We'll be ending off with monumental news of a spacecraft from the U.S. aerospace manufacturer SpaceX embarking on an Earth-circling trip with an all-amateur crew. The launch, labeled Inspiration 4, is a project in which four civilians travel into space without professional astronauts on board. Although this is the third private space tour, SpaceX differentiated itself with a three-day project in that it will orbit space for the longest time and have no professional aviator on board.
Yeah, so this is the third major player to successfully enter the privatized space race. Previously on the show, we covered at length Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic sending civilians to space, followed by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos's space company Blue Origin. Those flights included the founders Branson and Bezos on board. But who are the lucky four individuals to be part of SpaceX's venture then?
Jared Isaacman, billionaire CEO of payment processing company Shift for Payments. Isaacman played a vital role in making the mission possible as he purchased the flight for an undisclosed fee with the goal of raising awareness and funding for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Joining him is 29-year-old Haley Arsenault, a childhood bone cancer survivor who now works as a physician assistant where she was treated, St. Jude's. And sweepstakes winners Chris Dombrowski, a data engineer, and Sean Proctor, a community college educator, join them as well. That's all four. So unlike Branson and Bezos, SpaceX founder Elon Musk was not part of the crew.
Yes, I see. So these four people have been blasted off into space now, but you said it was a three-day trip. Can you tell us a bit more about the mission itself?
Sure. SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, USA at 8 p.m. on Wednesday local time. The Dragon capsule was transported into space on SpaceX's reusable launch vehicle Falcon 9. The Dragon capsule will navigate Earth's orbit at an altitude of around 360 miles for 3 days, and that's in fact 100 miles above the International Space Station. Benji Reed, Senior Director of Crew Mission Management at SpaceX, called this a monumental event as it is the highest space orbit any human has entered since the 2009 Hubble Space Telescope shuttle mission.
Yes, 360 miles. I understand that far outshoots Branson's and Bezos's flights that reached heights of just 53 and 62 miles respectively. And their flights lasted mere minutes compared to SpaceX's flight of 3 days. So what details do we know of the crew's safe return then?
Well, if all goes according to plan, the mission will come to a complete end when the capsule splashes down at its designated area off the coast of Florida. Mission control will need to keep tabs on Florida's temperamental weather, however, as it could affect the specific timing of splashdown.
I see. Well, good luck to them on their journey, and hopefully we'll see them back safe and sound on planet Earth soon. That's all we have time for on today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Yewon, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you, Chang. I'll see you next time.
It's time for Explore Korea, our weekly segment discovering more about the country's history, culture and travel highlights. Joining us this week on the line is Hannah Roberts from the blog Moonbear Travel. Hannah, welcome back on the show. It's great to have you with us again.
I'm glad to be back.
So what are you going to tell us about this week, Hannah?
So this week I'm actually going to kick off an exciting series that I will be doing alongside Ali, who listeners will probably know hosts the history segments on this show. For our next few appearances, we're going to be introducing the Feel the Rhythm of Korea video series created by the Korea Tourism Organization, also known as the KTO, and that advertises different cities around the country and the things you can do there.
Right. So to give our listeners a bit of background, last year the KTO released a series of videos that went viral. The videos featured different cities in Korea with music by a group called Inalchi and dancers from the Ambiguous Dance Company dancing in front of various tourist hotspots in these cities. Now, Inalchi is a musical group that creates fusion, pop and pansori, or traditional Korean storytelling songs. And the Ambiguous Dance Company is well known for their extravagant costumes and their extravagant dance moves. Now, this fusion of traditional and modern and a bit bizarre became a huge hit in Korea and elsewhere, especially the video featuring Inalchi's song 범 내려온다, or The Tiger is Coming. So it seems following on from that success, the KTO have produced a new video series this year. And Hannah, that's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The 2020 series was a massive hit with iconic costumes and music, like you said, in front of all of those really famous tourist hotspots across the country. But the KTO released a new series earlier this month, actually. This year's videos, they are in the same vein as those from last year, going to different places across the country. But the KTO has taken the opportunity this time to feature a variety of different musical groups and dance performers. There is a running theme, however, and that is that each song is based on or inspired by a classic pansori song.
Okay, so what more can you tell us about these new videos? What can we expect?
So there are 8 videos in the series. Some of the places are the same as last year, but some of them are new. Today I'm just going to tell you about the first two, which are both about Seoul. And they both feature at least 7 or 8 places each, though. So I thought later on I could choose some of the lesser-known spots to introduce you. Just a couple.
Sure. Before we get into the locations in the video, though, let's talk a little bit about the music first. Can you tell us about the pansori songs that the videos are inspired by?
Okay. So the first video in the series is called 사랑가, which is the name of the most famous pansori piece of all the 5 pansori cycles that are currently performed. So it's from the Pansori Chunhyanga, which is the most famous of those five. And it's about a forbidden love story between a low-born woman and an upper-class man. The title of the song, Saranga, literally means love song. And it's the part of the Pansori when the two lovers confess their feelings for one another. Now, in the video, the song City Love by PH1, the soundtrack to this first video in this series, it both expresses those feelings of love between two people, but it's also a bit of a love song to Seoul as well, you know, how you might feel when you're here or you come for the first time, and also when you're not here. I like how you miss it, that homesickness for the city.
Sure. So inspired by Saranga, this new song by PH1 has a mesmerizing slow tempo hip-hop R&B sound. What about the second video?
The second video is inspired by what is the most famous Korean folk song of all, and that's Arirang. It's not the national anthem of Korea, but it's often considered like an unofficial anthem of Korea. And nowadays, there are hundreds of variations of Arirang that exist. Because of all these variations, and the fact that the word Arirang is actually kind of nonsensical. It's hard to say what that word Arirang really means, but most variations of Arirang include themes of sorrow and separation, and a lot of them do include the theme of love. In the KTO video named after Arirang, they mentioned the Arirang Pass and kind of overcoming the Arirang Pass, like moving through it. And so the song featured is called Pass, and it's by the group Gemini. And in that song, they sing about persevering, moving up, moving past things, and how the city of Seoul helps them do that.
Right, and this song also has quite a modern, hypnotic R&B sound as well.
Yes.
Okay, and that's the music. And as we said, both the videos we're talking about today are about Seoul. But they're not all obvious locations, especially the second Seoul video. Hannah, can you walk us through some of the places that the video introduces us to?
Okay. Like you said, they have a bunch of different places that they feature, and not all of them are very well known. They are all great places. To listeners, if you have time, you need to go and watch these videos. But for time's sake, I could only choose one from each video. So the first one, the first video itself shows really nicely, I think, the coming together of old and new in the city. And my pick from this video is Seosomun Historical Park. It's the location of an execution site established in the mid-Joseon era that saw the executions of hundreds of Korean Catholics. And it even became Asia's first Catholic pilgrimage site in 2018. If you want to visit, you can take the subway to Cheongno Station or to Seoul Station. If you go to Seoul Station, you can walk north and pass under the reformed elevated highway Seollo 7017, which is also featured in that first video.
Right. We did talk about Seosomun Historical Park with Ali when we were introduced to Catholicism in Seoul in July, but accessing the park via Seollo 7017 does seem like quite a nice trip to have to reach there as well.
Yeah.
Okay, what's another place from the videos you think is worth highlighting?
So the second video focuses mainly on like retro Seoul. It includes places like Dongmyo Market, which is really popular for vintage shopping. And something I really like about the video is that it showcases the style, like actual fashion style, of a lot of the older generation living and working in the very central Jongno district. But the place from this video that I particularly want to recommend is Tapgol Park. Now, it's actually fairly well known and is often visited by tourists who are passing through and going to the famous Insadong Street. History buffs will know this place well, but not many first-time visitors to Seoul, I think, know its importance, you know, being the location of the origin of the March 1st independence movement. It's where the Proclamation of Independence was read for the very first time in 1919. It's also where the 1986 Peace March for Democracy ended, and it now houses several statues honoring Korean patriots through the years. And so to get there, you can take the subway to Jongno Samga, Jongno 3 station, and walk straight out of exit 1, or you can take the bus to the Jongno 3 Tapgo Park stop.
Right. Knowing that little bit of a history, I think, will help visitors take more away from the visit. And that was Tapgo Park, as you said. Well, Hannah, thank you for introducing us to those places. And for our listeners, as we said, this is going to be the start of an ongoing series with Hannah and Ali for Explore Korea, looking at the other locations featured in the KTO video series. For anyone curious about the videos, they should go to the KTO's YouTube channel called Imagine Your Korea and search for Feel the Rhythm of Korea. And you should be able to find all the videos and locations from this latest series, as well as from last year's as well. Well, that's all for Explore Korea this week. Hannah, thank you once again, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you. See you soon.
This is Scott Kelly, former NASA astronaut, and you're listening to Korea 24.
We come now to Morning Edition Preview, our closing segment where we take a look at some features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers. For that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, joining us now. Mark, hello.
Hello, good to see you.
So where are we headed to first today?
Right, we're going to head to the People's section of the Korea Times as Kim Bo-eun writes about the results of the resumed 2021 International Earth Science Olympiad, or the IESO, an annual competition for secondary school students that was canceled last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Kim writes that Korea did great this year at this year's IESO, coming in fourth overall among 32 countries. This year's competition was held online and comprised of an online test and a national team fielded investigation. And along with the competition itself, the event held presentations where students presented solutions to environmental issues. Kim writes that this year's competition presented questions on climate change, the COVID-19 pandemic, and exploring Mars.
So some very important issues indeed.
Issues as well. Exploring Mars is pretty awesome.
Sure. Let's move on to our second article. What do you have for us next?
Jungwa, have you ever had the chance to watch the incredibly popular Korean series on Netflix, DP?
Yes, I have. It's a very powerful and controversial series, of course, that's been causing a stir in Korea. For any listeners who might not know, DP is acronym for Deserter Pursuit. And the series is about the unit in the Korean military that hunts down deserters.
That's right.
The series also takes a deeper look into the nation's mandatory conscription system and the controversial issue of physical and mental abuse and bullying in the military.
That's right. Well, Choi Si-young has a huge piece on the Korea's Herald's Weekender. And at first glance, I really thought it was just about DP, but it's actually more about the civilian-led advisory panel that was put together in June to boost civilian oversight of the military. So it's the real stuff behind what influenced DP. The military is, in fact, now facing unprecedented reform efforts led by the said panel. However, Choi writes that there's been many scandals within the military that have come to light since the formation of the said panel, including sexual assault, abuse allegations, and subsequent cover-ups.
Right, so what are some of the things that this panel has done to push for changes within the military then?
Well, Choi's piece is really deep, so we're only going to have time to talk about one here. For one, at the panel's recommendation, the military recently handed over the power to investigate and try sex crimes to civilian authorities. For other crimes, the military courts are responsible for initial trials, but if they involve a soldier's death, they must go to civilian courts. And some panel members, Choi writes, originally sought to abolish the military court system altogether. But what about from the soldier's point of view? One rank-and-file recruit told the Herald that he preferred to go to a civilian court than a military court. He said it was because he felt more people were watching and he could expect a ruling he could trust. Now, I talked about just the panel's plan for the military court system, but to read all the other ways that the civilian-led panel plans to reform the military's disciplinary system, you need to pick up tomorrow's Herald. It's a very fascinating, very deep piece.
Yes, it sounds like a very good piece, especially as the DP TV series has cast such a spotlight on these issues once again. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's all for today as well. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
CBS World Radio.